1 Samuel chapter 1. There was a certain man from Ramathaim, a Ziphite from the hill country of Ephraim, whose name was Elkanah, son of Jeroham, the son of Elihu, the son of Tohu, the son of Zuf, an Ephraimite. He had two wives. One was called Hannah, and the other Peninnah. Peninnah had children, but Hannah had none. Year after year, this man went up from his town to worship and sacrifice to the Lord Almighty at Shiloh, where Hophni and Phinehas, the two sons of Eli, were priests of the Lord. Whenever the day came for Elkanah to sacrifice, he would give portions of the meat to his wife Peninnah and to all her sons and daughters. But to Hannah, he gave a double portion because he loved her and the Lord had closed her womb. Because the Lord had closed Hannah's womb, her rival kept provoking her in order to irritate her. This went on year after year. Whenever Hannah went up to the house of the Lord, her rival provoked her till she wept and would not eat. Her husband Elkanah would say to her, "Hannah, why are you weeping? Why don't you eat? Why are you downhearted? Don't I mean more to you than 10 sons? Once, when they had finished eating and drinking in Shiloh, Hannah stood up. Now Eli the priest was sitting on his chair by the doorpost of the Lord's house. In her deep anguish, Hannah prayed to the Lord, weeping bitterly. And she made a vow, saying, "Lord Almighty, if you will only look on your servant's misery and remember me, and not forget your servant, but give her a son, then I will give him to the Lord for all the days of his life, and no razor will ever be used on his head." As she kept on praying to the Lord, Eli observed her mouth. Hannah was praying in her heart, and her lips were moving, but her voice was not heard. Eli thought she was drunk and said to her, "How long are you going to stay drunk? Put away your wine." "Not so, my Lord," Hannah replied. "I am a woman who is deeply troubled. I have not been drinking wine or beer. I was pouring out my soul to the Lord. Do not take your servant for a wicked woman. I have been praying here out of my great anguish and grief." Eli answered, "Go in peace, and may the God of Israel grant you what you have asked of him." She said, "May your servant find favor in your eyes." Then she went her way and ate something, and her face was no longer downcast. Early the next morning, they arose and worshiped before the Lord, and then went back to their home at Ramah. Elkanah made love to his wife Hannah, and the Lord remembered her. So in the course of time, Hannah became pregnant and gave birth to a son. She named him Samuel, saying, "Because I asked the Lord for him." This is the word of the Lord. So just by a show of hands, how many of us here like waiting? Not even one. I mean, I guess it's like it depends on what you're waiting for, right? Sometimes waiting is okay. When we are anticipating that something good is coming, let's say, right? We're waiting for a big trip that we have been planning for months, or for a reunion, or for a celebration, a party, then sometimes the anticipation of that event is part of the fun. But when we are waiting for something to happen, and we don't know when that thing will happen, or even if that thing will happen, that waiting is hard. I was living in Michigan when the borders closed in March 2020. And we would Zoom with my family. We Zoomed every week. And at the beginning, we were like, okay, 30 days. We can do 30 days. And then they would extend the border closure another 30 days. And we would say, okay, like that's a little annoying, but it's fine. Like we don't have any planned trips to get home. And then it would get extended another 30 days. And finally, we started to cancel our summer vacation plans together. And then it kept getting extended and kept getting extended. And by February of 2021, I was a hot mess. I was restless. I was anxious. This was the longest I had ever gone without coming home, and I didn't know when I would get to come home. The waiting, the longing for home, and the not knowing of when that longing would be fulfilled was wearing on me. Waiting can be really hard. And Hannah is waiting. She has been waiting for years. She married Elkanah likely as a teenage girl, full of the promises of a long and happy life together, ready to start a family and create a home together. She moved into Elkanah's family home and learned to love the tree beside the house and the splash of mid-afternoon sunlight on the cool earthen floor over which she would dance and hum as she tidied up after a meal. Everyone knew Hannah to be lively and joyful, always smiling, always ready with a cheerful good morning as she moved through the market, both graceful and full of life. After a year went by with no sign of children, her smile shrunk ever just so much, and her waltz slowed by just a breath. After 2 years, she stopped calling out a morning greeting, just going with a nod and a small smile. After 3 years, she shuffled through the market, and the only feet that danced over the sunlight were those of the cat. After 4 years, Elkanah looks at her with sorrow in his eyes before he walks to the house of Peninnah to take her as a second wife. After 5 years, the sound of a child cooing finally fills the house, but it is not Hannah's child. A sound that should have filled her with delight instead becomes a mockery, reminding her every day of what she does not have. It doesn't matter that Elkanah favors Hannah, giving her twice as much food during the Feast of Tabernacles, looking at her with love and tenderness. If anything, that's maybe only made matters worse, because Elkanah's favoritism probably provokes Peninnah, whose jealous heart has led her to taunt Hannah over her barrenness. A woman who could not provide children for her husband, no male heir to continue the line, was an embarrassment and shame to her family. And Peninnah has no problem reminding Hannah of this. And so Hannah's smile over time is replaced by tears, anguished over her own loss, hurt by the cruelty of Peninnah, and carrying the weight of a husband who clearly loves her, but who, having secured his lineage with Peninnah, cannot seem to understand the pain it yet causes Hannah. And so it is a desperate Hannah who makes her way down to Shiloh with the rest of the family for the Feast of Tabernacles, the annual pilgrimage to the tabernacle to make sacrifice. She travels in silence, ignoring the jabs made by Peninnah, eating little, sometimes eating nothing. Even after the sacrifice at the temple in Shiloh, which is a time of giving thanks for God's bounty and goodness, Hannah eats nothing. How? How can she celebrate God's gift of abundant life? Instead, while the rest of the family is frolicking and laughing, she sneaks out and goes back up to the house of the Lord, though she only makes it as far as the steps before she collapses. Tears streaming down her face, she silently cries out to God, "Why have you not granted me the one thing that would make me happy? Why, after all these years of prayer, do you still not hear me? What must I do?" Hannah takes her hope and her anguish and her longing and brings it to the only place left to her, to her God. Hannah knows that any birth now will be a miracle. And so she places this possibility in God's hands, pledging to return the gift to God forever, to raise her child as a Nazirite, one whose whole life belongs to service of God, if God will but hear her cry. Someone sitting right there does hear Hannah's cry, though he doesn't understand it at first. Eli, the priest, sits on his chair, guarding the tabernacle from those who get a little carried away during feast time, when he sees Hannah break down on the steps. Annoyed, he calls over to Hannah, "How long are you going to stay drunk? Put away your wine already." Eli, the spiritual leader of the nation, does not recognize Hannah's genuine faith struggle. Yet another person is deaf to her cries of longing. We all know what it is to long for something, to be expectant, and to be disappointed. We know what it is to desire something so deeply and profoundly because it is a good thing, or because we have some sense of that we'll have wholeness when that thing comes to pass, or we believe we will be accepted when that thing finally arrives. After all, the expectations for what a proper life looks like, that wasn't just a thing in Hannah's time. Messages come at us from every which direction, both without and within the church, telling us what is expected of us, telling us what it means to live a good and whole life. So we're waiting for jobs, for the one person who's going to say yes to our resume after dozens of no's. We want to contribute. We want to feel useful. We want to know that we are making a difference. We want to be fulfilled. We want to measure up to people's expectations of us. And so we wait and we hope. Or we're waiting for relationships, for that perfect someone who will love us and stay with us and complete us. Or for the friend who will finally understand our sense of humor. For the colleague who will sit with us in the break room. We're longing for companionship, for an end to our loneliness. And so we go on dates, and we invite people out for coffee, and we smile hopefully when someone enters the room. And we wait, and we hope. We're waiting for kids, desperately longing to fill our house with laughter and small, warm bodies, to fill our house with new and curious ways of seeing the world, of a love that is pure and beautiful. And so every month we try, and every month we wait, and we hope. We're waiting for good news from the doctor, for a sign that the treatment is working, that the recovery has gone well, that the disease has not returned, that the body is healing. Every month, every 3 months, every 6 months, every year, we anticipate the next follow-up. And we wait. And we hope. And sometimes, many times, our waiting and our hoping is met by disappointment. We don't get the second interview. The person we hoped might be the one doesn't think it's going to work out. The crib remains empty. The margins aren't as clear as we would like them to be. And with each disappointment, we try to understand how this could be part of God's plan. Why does God not answer us in our waiting? Why does God not give us what we need? Hannah can't see how any of her sorrow could be part of God's plan. She feels empty and incomplete. How could God want this for her? Why would God withhold this thing, this one thing that would prove her place in the world, in the family, that would make her feel whole, that would remove from her all of the shame and embarrassment? And it's this anguish that she leaves at Eli's feet. "I'm not drunk," she says. "I am pouring out my soul to the Lord. Don't think of me as being so worthless. Plenty of people already do." And Eli, moved at last to compassion, blesses her. "May the God of Israel grant what you have asked of him." That's all he says, but it's enough. It's enough to cause Hannah to lift her face up to Eli, tears still glistening in her eye, but a soft smile spreading across her face for the first time in years. The smile remains as she goes back to Elkanah and the others. The smile remains as they return home, the others bemused at this change in countenance. And the smile grows a little wider as she grows a little bigger, as the child inside her grows month by month until finally Hannah has a child, a son, and she names the boy Samuel because he was asked of God. Except that in Hebrew, the name Samuel doesn't actually translate to asked of God. Shem in Hebrew is name, and El is God. So Shemuel, or Samuel, is name of God. So why does the narrator tell us something different? Well, the Hebrew name that does mean asked of God is Saul. And if you were an ancient Israelite listening to this story, it wouldn't be too difficult to put some pieces together. In our Bible, in the way our Bible is structured, 1 Samuel comes after the book of Ruth. But in the Hebrew canon, the book of 1 Samuel comes directly after the book of Judges. And Judges ends in despair as everyone did what was right in his or her own eyes when there was no king in Israel. 1 Samuel begins with a story involving Eli and his sons Hophni and Phinehas, both of whom were evil and corrupt. At this time, Israel is in desperate need of deliverance, of guidance, of a new moral compass. And Samuel is the one who then anoints Saul, the first king of Israel. And so we, as the readers, can see that Hannah's prayer has not just one, but two answers. She prays for a child who will restore her to her sense of personhood. Through her child, God will give Israel what they ask for, a king to protect them, to restore them to their sense of sovereignty and peace. Only it doesn't look like that hope is going to be quite fulfilled either, because Israel's kings turn out to be, many of them, at least as evil as Hophni and Phinehas, and as spiritually deaf as Eli. And so I think there's a reason that this story is placed in our Bible after the book of Ruth. Because Ruth, also childless and alone, has her prayers answered through her marriage to Boaz, and in the birth of her child, Obed, father of Jesse, father of David, from whose line would come the Savior of the whole world, the one who would bring true peace, the true King. God had a plan bigger than Hannah or Ruth or Samuel or Saul or David. Hannah might never have known why God chose to answer her prayer the way he did and when he did. And she would not have known the role her son would play in God's big plan of salvation. We don't ever really know why God answers prayers the way he does. But we can trust that he does have a plan. That he answers prayers maybe in mysterious ways, but in ways governed by his knowledge of all that is to come, and from his own goodness and provision and grace. The means for living the good life, according to God, are so much bigger than our own expectations, because God is so much bigger than our own expectations. And so he answers our own prayers, sometimes in fullness and sometimes in mystery. We get the job of our dreams and spend every day looking to steward that job well for the kingdom. Or we find a job that's just a job. But through it, we meet some remarkable people. We're able to provide for a loved one. We come to see that all our work can be meaningful when done in the service of another. We find our special someone and we get married and we promise to open up our homes to all those who are looking to belong, to call someone or some place home. Or we are that person, still waiting for a spouse, but also now filled with the love of a community that we may not otherwise have experienced. We have kids. And it's such a big love and a big commitment. Or after our waiting, we choose to adopt, to experience love that is chosen but no less real. Or we pour into the lives of our nieces and nephews, choosing to be the very best and coolest aunt or uncle imaginable. And our lives are yet filled with friends and laughter and new experiences. The surgery goes well, and the margins come back clear. Or we find out that we're facing chemo and radiation, that the cancer might never go away. And even in the midst of that, we experience the love of a community that rallies around us, the steadfastness of a family and friends, the overwhelming peace of God. And in all of these situations, there might yet be grief. It is perfectly possible to trust God and to be sad at the same time. The little ache of our longing might never go away. And so, as a community, then, we are called to bear witness to the aches of the other. It was enough for Hannah to hear Eli pray for her and with her, to name the importance of her longing. We too are called to name one another's longings, to name our desires and our needs and our uncertainties and our fears, to be with one another in the longing, and so to bear witness to the God who loves us in the longing, who is faithful and present to us in the longing. To bear witness to the one who was the answer to Hannah's prayer, though she could not know it. to bear witness to Jesus, who entered into our longing by becoming one of us, a light to a people waiting in darkness, enfolding us and our hopes and our fears into himself, the very best answer to our longings. Would you pray with me? God of time and space, the first and the last, the beginning and the end, God of past, present, and future, be with us in our waiting. As you know what has been and what is to come, so you know the longings of each of our hearts, those things that we hold close and dear, our hopes and desires, our anxieties and our fears. You know the longings of our hearts. We know that your own longing is for us, that you are for us and with us, and you want nothing more than for us to find our rest, our peace, and our hope in you. And so help us to trust you, God, to trust in your goodness, in the plans you have for us, in your presence, even amidst our uncertainty. We do not know your ways, and we can only begin to fathom your goodness. But we know that you love us, that you sent your Son to die for us, that we are held fast by you. So hold us in our waiting, that we might find our rest in you. Amen.